How are we meant to think about the value of a scarce asset that is programmed to become exponentially more rare over time when it's measured in a financial system where the units of measurement in that system are also required to expand in total amount forever for that system to survive? It's the $1 million question, or the one Bitcoin question for our time, and we are watching it play out in real time. And our guest this week has joined us for a conversation to dive into those opposing forces and what it might mean for people trying to make sense of Bitcoin. Mitchell Askew is the lead analyst at Blockware, which is a vertically integrated mining company based in the US. And I'm Scott Dietels, the CEO and founder of Block Rewards. And part of our mission in bringing Bitcoin to the workplace is helping people understand how it will help them. If you're interested to learn a little bit about how Bitcoin's mechanics create scarcity and how that scarcity should be thought about in a financial system that needs to expand forever, stick around. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. We are joined this week by special guest Mitchell Askew. Mitchell, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Scott. I'm excited to chat.
We're probably going to take a deep dive down the whole of monetary theory, quality of money, macroeconomics, all things Bitcoin. Maybe before we get started, can you just give us a quick TLDR introduction of yourself for our audience?
Yeah, so my name's Mitchell Askew. It's at Mitchell Hoddle on Twitter, if you've seen me. I've been working in the Bitcoin industry for about 2.5 years, specifically in the mining sector. I've been involved with Bitcoin in general for about 4 years. So it's kind of the end of 2020 after they printed all that money during COVID. I kind of got the inkling that the dollar might start to lose purchasing power. And so, you know, that led me down the Austrian economics rabbit hole, the Bitcoin rabbit hole, all of the fun rabbit holes, creature from Jekyll Island. And so in the last 4 years have been a trip. Definitely, you come out, once you start studying Bitcoin, you're a much different person than when you first found it. I'm sure a lot of your audience can relate to that.
It's amazing how many people have that story. That's my story, is I was sitting at home watching Netflix for the first week of March of 2020. And then I started getting curious about what money printing was going to do to purchasing power. And it actually did lead me eventually to The Creature from Jekyll Island, which is a book I talk about a lot. And yeah, there are a lot of us. And I think a lot of like our listeners are probably people that are now kind of in this next wave of, you know, seeing the impact of that inflation and wondering, you know, how does Bitcoin possibly present any kind of a solution for the hot water that we're in.
Yeah. Well, that's good to know. I feel like being around for a cycle, have a little bit of wisdom I can feed into, you know, the class of 2024, but there's certainly many, many more seasoned hodlers than myself. It does feel really strange now to come out of, like, because, you know, when you first get into Bitcoin, you hear about these bad bear markets and people hodling through and you're like, oh, you know, it's easy. I could probably do that. And then once you've done it, you know, you've got like balls of steel. You just totally come out of the bear market into the bull, just like ready to go. So it's I'm excited to talk. And, you know, I think Bitcoin has been kind of like a boring last 6 months. Like, you know, we've been just kind of trading sideways in this 60K range. But I do think, you know, price wise, we are finally going to start to see some action here in Q4 and into Q1 of next year.
Yeah, I think the bear markets make people impatient for the bull markets. And there is a mechanism in the Bitcoin protocol that reduces the rewards paid out to Bitcoin miners, which does have a historical correlation to, you know, eventually the price making explosive moves. That might be a really cool place to start. Like, can you just, you know, give us a little rundown of the block reward and how the block reward reduction might impact or has in the past like made a difference for Bitcoin's price?
Yeah, I think it's a very fitting conversation given the name of this podcast. But there's a lot of debate within the Bitcoin community of whether or not the halving, which is what you're talking about here, is actually bullish for Bitcoin. Because if you look historically, there's a strong correlation, right? You have these halvings every 4 years, and then about 6 to 12 to 18 months after, the Bitcoin price goes up exponentially. But there is a camp that says, yeah, the halving causes this. Like, this is halving's a bullish event because the inflation rate of Bitcoin gets cut in half, less supply, you know, less sell side pressure in the market causes the price to go up. But then there's another group of people that say, oh, it's pure coincidence. Bitcoin's more tied to global liquidity cycles. And I think the truth lies somewhere in the middle. I think both play a significant role. And I personally do think the halving is bullish, and it's for a few reasons. Number one is it eliminates the weakest Bitcoin miners from the network. So when we talk about a weak Bitcoin miner, what do we mean? We mean a miner who is barely breaking even. Basically, they spend as much in electricity to mine a Bitcoin as it costs to buy a Bitcoin. So what that means is a lot of the Bitcoin that they do mine, they're having to sell to cover their electricity expense. So if you think, you know, Bitcoin at $60,000, a miner who spent $30,000 on electricity to mine one Bitcoin, they're only having to sell half a Bitcoin to cover that electricity, versus a miner who spends $55,000 in electricity to mine one $60,000 Bitcoin, they're selling, you know, 90% of the Bitcoin they mine just to pay their electricity bill. And so those weaker miners, you know, they have higher power costs, they have less efficient machines. Those are the ones that are most affected by the halving. As the block subsidy gets cut in half, their revenue's cut in half, all of a sudden these miners that were barely profitable, all of a sudden they become unprofitable. And so you get these weakest miners coming off the network. They're unplugging their machines, they're winding down their operations, and they were the largest source of sell pressure. So having the miners that were selling the most Bitcoin leave the industry is going to be bullish, right? Because you're getting that drop in supply being regularly sold into the market. And if you look at mining difficulty or hash rate, essentially it's the same metric. How much computational power is dedicated towards Bitcoin mining? If you go back to the halving, April 19th versus today, October 2nd, it's actually like right the exact same amount, actually, because we, you know, we've had a few positive difficulty adjustments, a few negative, but net net, we still have about the same amount of miners on the network, which is abnormal, right? Typically, if you look over any sort of 6 month window, you're going to see hash rate go up. And so hash rate kind of moving sideways, that to me is telling you, hey, you are still seeing these weaker miners unplugged from the network. You've seen quite a number of negative difficulty adjustments in the mining industry. We call them miner capitulation. So when there's a net decrease in hash rate over a month, 2 month period, we call that a miner capitulation. And this is all during the same time that a new wave of ASICs. So mining technology has actually increased. So you have more efficient, more powerful machines hitting the market right now. So you would expect hash rate to go up. But the fact that it's moved sideways over the last 6 months tells me there's still weaker miners kind of depleting their treasury, selling Bitcoin into the market, just trying to stay afloat. And so I think once we really see the end of that miner capitulation, I think that's when we can really start to see price take off. But it could be a little while because we just had a negative difficulty adjustment. The next one's also projected to be negative. So I think once we start to see a few positive difficulty adjustments, that's a sign that, hey, you know, the miners selling a lot of Bitcoin are gone. It's only the strong ones here. Less sell pressure, Bitcoin price has to adjust accordingly.
It's an ultra complex ecosystem where new Bitcoins enter the Bitcoin network through miners. And that is something, and those Bitcoins are sold. So this is what you're describing. There's a term that you've used a few times there that I think might also be worth spending 2 minutes on, which is the difficulty adjustment, which is a really cool and ingenious aspect of how this all works. But what is a difficulty adjustment?
Yeah, the difficulty adjustment is a core feature of Bitcoin. If this didn't exist, all 21 million Bitcoin would have been mined within the first year. So essentially, this means that no matter how much computational power is being used to mine Bitcoin, whether it's a single MacBook in someone's garage or every computer, every data center all around the world trying to mine Bitcoin, no matter how much computational power there is, it's only going to be a Bitcoin block mined about every 10 minutes. Yeah. It's an average, right? So 10 minutes is a moving average. You know, some blocks might get mined instantly. Some blocks might take an hour to get mined. But if you look over the long run, blocks take 10 minutes to get mined. And so what is the effect of this? It means that Bitcoin, it has this 21 million supply cap, but all 21 million Bitcoin won't be mined for another 116 years. So at 2140, that's when all the Bitcoin get mined. Versus if you compare this concept to other commodities, if more people start to mine gold, you will find more gold. The supply of gold will increase at a faster rate. But when more people start to mine Bitcoin, the difficulty adjusts. So the literal amount of computational power you need to mine a Bitcoin increases directly proportionally to the amount of miners there are. So no matter how many people are mining Bitcoin, a block every 10 minutes, which means right now, it's about 3.125 new Bitcoin enter circulation every 10 minutes, no matter how many miners there are. And so this just creates a really fascinating dynamic where even if the price of Bitcoin goes up and more people start to mine, it doesn't mean more Bitcoin will get mined at any faster of a rate.
Yeah, and to scope that out like into a much longer, we've never, ever, ever had something like this for human consumption, where at a programmed rate, the available amount is going to decline exponentially globally at a time where theoretically the number of people who or entities that would be interested in owning it or using it is going to be going in the opposite direction, exponentially up. And this process will continue forever, like you said, for the next 116 years. So it's like 3 Bitcoin every 10 minutes might seem like a small number, but you know, it'll be less than one, and then it'll be fractions of a Bitcoin. Like, this is during a time when most of us probably should still be alive. So we are gearing up for quite a wild ride of scarcity.
Yeah. And one more point I'd add to that is it really solves this kind of paradox you have of money. So good money is scarce, right? You're not going to be able to produce it easily. It's going to have a finite supply. But also for good money, you want it to be widely distributed. So an example would be, you know, the Mona Lisa is scarce. There's only one Mona Lisa, but there's only one Mona Lisa. So it can't actually be used for trade because most people don't have access to it. So for a good money, you need something that's scarce, but also widely distributed. And so the fact that Bitcoin does have this programmatic distribution schedule solves this paradox, because you have the limited supply of 21 million, but it's, you know, Bitcoin's been around for 15 years. It's very popular. All the traditional financial institutions are trying to get a hold of Bitcoin, but there's still, you know, 1.2 million Bitcoin that are going to get mined over the next 116 years. So even if you're being born, you know, 50 years from now, you'll still have an opportunity to acquire Bitcoin. It's not, you know, if we didn't have the difficulty adjustment, Satoshi would have mined all 21 million Bitcoin, and then it wouldn't be any good because nobody would have any, right? And people talk about this concept a lot with the idea of Bitcoin faucets. So if early in Bitcoin's days, when, you know, they were worth pennies or less than pennies, people would set up these websites where you could just distribute Bitcoin. You go on there, you put in your address, they'll send you 50, 100 Bitcoin for free or whatever. And people look back in hindsight, well, like, that's stupid. Why would you give away, you know, those, the 100 Bitcoins worth tens of millions of dollars now? But, yeah, and we'll never necessarily have the answer to this question. But if we didn't have those faucets, would Bitcoin actually have reached where it's at today? Because it wouldn't have been widely distributed. Only sort of the OG cypherpunks would have had any. So the way the difficulty adjustment, the halvings work, it solves this paradox of money being scarce, but also widely distributed and widely available.
Yeah, some great points there, Mitchell. And it makes me think as well, it also solves the problem of historically, commodities have experienced monetization organically. Like, gold was something that became a money over time as the result of exhibiting the qualities of money. And this is sort of like an intelligence that people sort of intuit without needing to be told, which I think is something that's absolutely going on with Bitcoin. Here, your story makes me think of this famous StarCraft tournament that happened, I think, maybe like 12, 13 years ago, where the first prize was $500 and the fourth prize, like the consolation prize, was like 500 Bitcoin. And so it was just so funny that... at the time, you know, it was more of a novelty, like a giveaway, like what you're talking about.
You know, one more point to add there, Scott, because this idea of, you know, commodities sort of monetizing naturally, humans now in 2024 don't see it that way, because the dollar has been forced upon us by the government, right? It's a state-run monetary system, essentially. And so people think the dollar only has value because the government says so and not because society chose it naturally. And I don't think that's the case. I think a good example of sort of monies or any commodity monetizing naturally is if you look at prisons. What is used as money in a prison? It's cigarettes. And this happens naturally. Nobody forces the prisoners to choose cigarettes. It's simply, you know, it's scarce, they're fungible, they're always in high demand, they're very portable, concealable. And so this is a natural, you know, any society, any economy, no matter how primitive or how large, they're going to choose the best tool for money to be the money, the thing that they can reliably hold and then trade for goods or services in the future. And despite all of fiat's flaws, you know, the dollar, for those who aren't familiar with the term fiat money, despite all of its flaws, I actually do think humans chose the dollar naturally back in the early 1900s. And the reason being is gold was money before, and it's great at storing value across time, but it's not very portable and it's not very divisible. And as kind of the speed of trade increased with nationwide railroads, the actual speed of commerce increased. And so you needed a money that was quicker. And so they were naturally kind of gravitating to paper claims on gold, which eventually evolved into fiat. And so you needed a money that could keep up with the speed of commerce. And so I do think, despite, you know, all of the things on Jekyll Island, which I totally agree, it was, you know, the Federal Reserve was created hostily because they wanted these group of bankers wanted to keep their power. I do think humans naturally chose fiat because of gold's sort of inherent flaws and that it's physical and heavy, which, you know, that whole idea is bullish for Bitcoin, right? Because Bitcoin takes what's best of fiat, which is this portability and divisibility, and then it takes the best of gold, which is the scarcity, and it combines both of them into one. So I think over time, we'll see society choose the new best money, which is Bitcoin. Again, it's only been 15 years since Bitcoin was created. I don't think it's going to happen overnight, but I think another 15 years, another 30 years, 45 years, we'll see more and more of society choose the best money, which is Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's as you mentioned, it sort of combines all these great qualities of money, creating sort of a new kind of digital, non-physical hard money, which is really what humanity would need for the digital age. And I was thinking about, you know, as you're talking, this concept of faucets, and this is a question that I get a lot, which, you know, how does Bitcoin become the money when the people who are early are holding a disproportionate amount of it? But I think a different kind of faucet that is also true are people who do eventually sell some Bitcoin over time as it has appreciated. So people who bought it at $100, almost none of them are holding all of their Bitcoin still. And like the big early holders, like Max Keiser is a great example. It freely gives away Bitcoin all the time. And so I think that there will be continual and ongoing, like, as you mentioned, kind of classes of people who eventually it will make sense to part with some Bitcoin. And it just is sort of like depends on the order that you got into the queue.
Yeah. And if you look on chain, great thing about Bitcoin is it's a totally transparent monetary system. It supports exactly what you said. There is data and evidence to back this up. So I put charts out on my Twitter before. The amount of Bitcoin that's held in addresses that hold less than one Bitcoin, less than a tenth of a Bitcoin, less than a hundredth of a Bitcoin, that supply is growing versus the amount of Bitcoin that's held in addresses with 100 Bitcoin, 1,000, 10,000 Bitcoin. Their supply is dropping, right? So you are seeing Bitcoin become more widely distributed. It's leaving the hands of these whales and it's going to smaller on-chain addresses, smaller on-chain entities. And it's simply because Bitcoin doesn't allow for net consumers to accumulate Bitcoin. So in the fiat system, if you imagine someone who's retired and they have $10 million in treasury bonds, they can spend and be a net consumer, right? They're no longer working. They're no longer producing value for society. And I don't mean that in a knock. They're just simply retired. They're not working, right? They're a net consumer. And so they consume more than they produce. But you can see their fiat net worth go up, which is very interesting, right? Because you think if money is used to measure your worth and value to society, if you're a net consumer, your nominal net worth should be going down. But because the supply of fiat's constantly expanding, you know, they can hold these treasury bonds, kind of live off the interest and the yield from that, and then also keep some and have their nominal net worth go up. But in a sound money system like Bitcoin, you don't see this. So someone who's a net consumer who has a bunch of Bitcoin, they sell a little bit of their stack every year to finance their lifestyle. Well, their nominal Bitcoin net worth is going to go down. The actual amount of Bitcoin they're holding, they're holding less over time, which because they're selling it, right? And so fiat's allowed this distortion where you could be a net consumer, but you feel like you're getting richer. You feel like you're contributing to society and your net worth is growing simply because the measurement you're using, dollars, is a flawed measure. And so Bitcoin doesn't allow for that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I'm not sure I've ever heard it articulated exactly that way. So you make some great points. You know, I think this is a good time to talk a little bit about the inflationary monetary system and why. So at the outset of the conversation, you mentioned that there's sort of like two large 50,000 foot things that could be impacting the Bitcoin price. And one of them is scarcity and the other one is global liquidity. So let's just talk a little bit about what that means and what are the short and, you know, permanent prospects for the ongoing expansion of the fiat money system.
Yeah. So to further kind of expand on this idea of the two impactors, it's supply and demand essentially, right? So the scarcity of Bitcoin is the supply, and then global fiat liquidity, that's demand. So as there's more dollars, that means there's more dollars to try to buy Bitcoin with. And so there's more demand. And so what you've seen over the last 6, 7, 8, 10 decades is the supply of fiat currency, the supply of dollars within the system grows at a rate of about 7% per year. And so that's roughly equal to the growth in the S&P 500 and the growth in real estate prices over the last few decades, right? It's 7%. So the money supply grows. There's more dollars people can buy. You know, they have more dollars in their pocket to buy goods and services. So they bid the price up, prices increase. This is how inflation works. And so we are entering kind of a new regime now where the money supply is going to continue to grow, right? Over the last 4 years. So if you think back 4 years ago, they printed a bunch of money during COVID and then they tried to reverse it really quickly in 2022. They jacked interest rates way, way up on a percentage basis. The chart's so silly. I'll have to find it and send it to you so you can put it in the show notes. It's like the percent change in the Fed funds rate. So not like, you know, they went from 0% Fed funds to 0.75%. But if you break that down in an actual like percentage basis, it's like millions of percent increase, right? If you go from 0.02 to 0.75. And so they hiked interest rates like never before. They're trying to suck money out of the system. And so that's why in 2022, all of asset prices went down. Bitcoin went down. Stock prices went down. Gold went down. Treasury bonds went down because money's getting sucked out of the system. And so at this point in the, you know, the state of the US fiscal debt, right? We're $35 trillion in debt. The government's debt to GDP is about 120%. We're in such an over-leveraged, hyper-financialized world that there's one trade within financial markets. It's, is money being put into the system or is money being sucked out of the system? And so by the Federal Reserve lowering interest rates recently, we're going to start to see even more money be put into the system. And the reason this is the case is simply because banks lend out more money than they have in reserves. It's a fractional reserve system. So if they have $100 in the bank, they might be lending out, or sorry, if they have $100 worth of deposits, they're going to be lending out $1,000 or $10,000, right? And so lower interest rates is going to incentivize more people to borrow, which means there's going to be more lending, which means more credit, which is essentially money being put into the system. Prices are going to rise accordingly. And so as we see the Federal Reserve continue to lower interest rates over the next 12 months, we're going to see more borrowing. Asset prices are going to go up. And then you're also going to see money come out of sort of other assets, right? So when rates, interest rates are high, you can see treasury bonds, they had a yield of, you know, 5%, right? And so a lot of your fat suit investors, they're playing it safe. They want just a guaranteed return. 5% on treasuries is pretty good, right? So they're like, hey, I could just lend money to the government, get a guaranteed 5%, meet my fiduciary responsibilities, get my bonus at the end of the quarter, whatever. But as treasury rates start to come down, it's like, all right, well, now treasuries are only giving me 2% or 3%. So I'm going to have to go somewhere else to get higher returns to sort of meet my obligations. And so then they're putting money into stocks, they're putting money into Bitcoin, they're putting money into other assets simply because treasury bonds aren't yielding enough. And so I know that was kind of a lot there. We can pull on any one of those threads, but the net of it is the lower interest rates means more money means higher asset prices.
Yeah. So maybe one thread to tug on there is, what is the argument for, as more money becomes available, why Bitcoin is a better choice than some of those other asset classes you mentioned, like bond, stocks, and real estate?
Yeah. So first, we could go with sort of the quantifiable answer, which is that it has been the one that performs the best historically. So I mentioned at the early part of this podcast, you know, is the halving bullish or is Bitcoin just tied to global liquidity? Because if you look historically, when do you see global liquidity expand? So not just dollars, but, you know, the euro, the yen, the Chinese yuan. When total fiat liquidity increases, you see this exponential move in the Bitcoin price. And then when fiat gets sucked out of the system, like in 2022, Bitcoin also responds the most to the downside. So simply mathematically, Bitcoin has the strongest correlation to global liquidity. And Sam Callahan and Lynn Alden put out some great research on this a week or two ago, showing exactly what that correlation is and comparing it to other asset classes. So first answer would be yes, you know, quantifiably, historically, Bitcoin has been the most tied to liquidity. But if we get into more of a qualitative reason, like why is this the case? Well, it's because of this term Michael Saylor calls it the inflationary coefficient. And what this means is that goods that are hard to produce, goods that are scarce, they are more responsive to changes in liquidity. A good way to think of this would be, think about Kraft mac and cheese, right? Very abundant. You can mass produce it, you know, millions and millions and millions of units easily. There's virtually no cost. And so as the money supply increases, you can also increase the supply of Kraft mac and cheese at the same rate, right? So they're both increasing. So the actual price of Kraft mac and cheese won't go up that much. Versus compare that to Miami Beach real estate. You know, the supply of dollars is increasing. You can't increase the supply of Miami Beach real estate overnight. And so you're going to see the price of Miami Beach real estate increase a lot more than the price of Kraft mac and cheese. And so Bitcoin is just the continuation of this idea. It's absolutely scarce. There's only 21 million versus you compare to the stock of a company. You know, the money supply can increase. They can issue more shares, right? They can dilute the supply of their stock. And so by virtue of being the only absolutely scarce commodity there is, Bitcoin inherently has to respond the most to changes in the money supply.
Yeah, and I think this comes back very nicely to a point you made earlier about the Mona Lisa, where there are actually, you know, there are absolutely finite things, but it's just that those things aren't divisible and they aren't portable. So this isn't something that the masses have any opportunity to really participate in. I love Michael Saylor talking about this idea of, you know, if it's Miami Beach real estate or it's real estate in Manhattan in the 1700s, like you're really having the opportunity to buy something that is as scarce as something could possibly be, but that it is also divisible and you can own $100 of it if that's what you can afford to do. So I think that that is also another one of these dynamics that is really just new and weird and difficult for people to understand. Like, so I guess, you know, tying into this idea of like, why is this thing attractive and potentially a better alternative than other assets? A very simple way to think about it is this concept of the scarcity, while it's also very available.
Right. 100%, right? Because it's easy to get caught up in kind of like, I hate the term privilege, but in America, we are privileged. We have access to US financial markets. We can buy equity in the best businesses in the world, but that's not the case for a lot of people in other countries, right? And so everywhere is affected by inflation. So if you live in a third world country, what can you buy to protect yourself from inflation? Because you can't buy US stocks. Real estate in your area is probably not very desirable, right? You know, if you're in a place that's run by gangs and cartels, like nobody wants to own land there. It's just not a great investment, right? And so what can you hold to preserve your purchasing power? Well, maybe you can hold gold, but you know, if it's a dangerous country, you could get robbed. Like you don't necessarily want to hold that. You could get scammed with fake gold. It's like you want to hold Bitcoin. That's the only thing that's globally available to everyone to hold. And, you know, I guess one more point I would add there is, in terms of moving the needle on asset prices, you do want to track, you know, what are the wealthiest people in the world doing? It's one thing if all the people in the third world start to save in Bitcoin. Like, I think that would be great. Very, you know, it's a morally good thing. They'll be able to save their purchasing power. But in terms of actually moving the Bitcoin price, might not have that great of an impact. Like, let's just be honest. They don't have a lot of wealth to save people in other countries. What are the American financial institutions doing? Because they have the most wealth in the world. And they're buying Bitcoin. You've seen Larry Fink of BlackRock go on these national shows and talk about how he's talking about the same things we are, that Bitcoin is a solution to inflation. It is a great place to hide from, you know, government debasement of the currency. The US is in this massive debt spiral and Bitcoin's a great way to protect yourself against that. This is the president of the largest asset manager in the entire world. He's saying these things. So obviously, some very important people, very wealthy people understand this and they're accumulating Bitcoin. So it's, you know, I would do as they're doing, if I'm being honest.
Yeah. One of my favorite ways to wrap my head around this is something that Seyfi Moose talks about, where it's not that the financial system or the money system is broken. It's the money system is actually working exactly as it's supposed to. And this is just a feature of how it works, where we have erected a global financial system around this concept of liquidity. And over time, more and more money comes in. And eventually, as it does that and devalues the money, it's also sort of simultaneously devaluing the debt and the money that's been borrowed, which kind of makes it manageable, somehow keeps this thing chugging along. I don't know, I've seen you talk about this before, and maybe it's worth just talking about that for 2 minutes.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, you hear people, anybody, not just Bitcoiners, talk about this all the time. The idea, the quote unquote system is broken. You know, the system is rigged. It's almost this like straw man, boogeyman argument. And you make a great point. The system is not broken. This is how the system is designed to work. So you need to study our monetary system and understand all you have to do is buy assets, right? Because it is the currency will get devalued by design. Because think about it logically, if you are $1 trillion in debt Is it easier to actually work and labor and earn $1 trillion legitimately, or just 10x the money supply, where suddenly $1 trillion is just a smaller fraction of the total money supply? That's going to be an easier way to pay back your debt. And so you're going to forever see this debasement of the currency, the growth of the money supply. And so, yeah, it's not that the system is rigged necessarily. I mean, you could say that it's rigged, but it's not broken. This is how it works. This is how it always has worked. And this is why the rich continue to get richer and the poor get poorer, right? The rich understand the framework that we're playing. And then the poor don't even realize the game that's being played, right? They're just saving in dollars, or maybe they're not even saving at all. And so those who save in assets, those who actually get into debt, not consumer debt, you know, you're not putting your trip to Disney World on a credit card, that type of debt. You're using debt to buy assets, right? A mortgage or like long-term notes to buy hard things, right? Because the debt loses value, but then the asset actually grows in value. So it's, this is how the system works, and you need to accumulate assets, and you, unfortunately, you have to play the game. But I think Bitcoin allows you to opt out in a certain way, because you don't have to necessarily speculate. You can just buy and hold Bitcoin, and you know that they're going to continue to print dollars, but you still have, you know, your slice of the 21 million pie.
There's also, I think, something important to discuss that we tend to focus on. I mean, this, I'm in Canada, but this is sort of probably a largely North American audience pod, and or we'll say the Western world. And we're recording this at the beginning of October. There are a few different things happening right now that are kind of global liquidity event concerns. One of them is China is experiencing its own sort of domestic financial meltdown, and they are creating tons and tons of yuan. And whatever is unfolding right now in Israel could be political, you know, commentary aside. Like, these are things that tend to be very expensive, and be large liquidity. Global conflicts tend to be large liquidity events. So, yeah, maybe your thoughts on what is happening in the broader world, and what we should be thinking about as we're thinking about the total amount of money in the whole world.
Yeah, I think this. These actions recently by the People's Bank of China are very interesting. And I'm not 100% solidified on all the details, but I know they lowered reserve requirements for banks. They lowered sort of the required down payment for a mortgage, which means you're putting less money down, you're borrowing more, which expands the money supply. They lowered their kind of version of the Fed funds rate. So they did a bunch of stuff to incentivize more credit creation and expand liquidity. And I've always, going back to kind of when I was in college studying global monetary policy, how different banks and different foreign currencies operate, to me, it's this weird, like a dick measuring competition of who could devalue their currency the most. Because as the Chinese expand their money supply, it'll be cheaper for people to buy goods from China, because the yen or the yuan is losing purchasing power relative to other nations' currencies. And so if you're United States, you don't want other countries buying more goods from China. So you want to devalue the dollar so you can export more goods to the world. And so you just get this rapid race of who can devalue their currency the most. And, you know, you get brief periods like in 2022 where currencies strengthen and global liquidity gets sucked out of the system, but that's unsustainable for long periods of time. And so seeing China do this just bazooka of quantitative easing and really devaluing the yen or the yuan, then it's going to force other nations and specifically the United States to do the exact same thing. And there are all sorts of different central banks in the world. Each major country has their own, but they tend to just behave in a very similar fashion. So the Fed was the last to start cutting rates. The first rate cut was in September, but earlier this year, all the other powerful G7 central banks started cutting rates as well. So, you know, there may be a little bit of delay between them, but they're all doing the same thing, which is expanding the money supply. And seeing China do it so aggressively, I think, is very telling for what has to come in the United States.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's a great point to sort of connect the dots for the listeners where this matters. Is most people still tend to measure the, you know, how they're doing with Bitcoin in terms of the pieces of paper that they're able to trade it for versus like how much pieces of paper they bought it for versus how much pieces of paper they sold it for. But the devaluation of those pieces of paper, regardless of what color they are and where you live, is something that's going to have to be ongoing and accelerate. And, you know, it's better off to think about how much of the finite thing that you have, because that's really the one thing in it's like a fixed point in space. It's the one thing that's not moving. And everything else is like, you know, it's kind of like one of those carnival basketball games where the net is moving and you're trying to shoot at a moving net. Like it's really hard to tell how well you're even doing. And I think about this in terms of, in investing, it's a common term of real rate of return, which most people tend to think of is the difference between kind of CPI and whatever you did on your investments. So if the inflation index is 3% or the target of 2% and you got 7, then you've made 5% and you've come out ahead. But if the money is actually devaluating at 7% or 10%, or I've seen much higher estimates in countries outside of the US where the money tends to work worse. Yeah, it's a confusing thing that that a lot of people get trapped in by just not understanding the reality of what's happening.
Yeah, I agree. And I think measuring in terms of dollars, it's flawed. I think a better way to measure your returns or just net worth overall, one would be to look at Bitcoin, but we'll circle back to that. Measuring your net worth and your returns in terms of like local real estate in your area. And so it's going to vary jurisdictionally. But I was having a conversation with my friend the other day. He's like, oh yeah, I bought this house, 3 years ago. I could sell it now and I made 30% more money. When I'm trying to explain to him, I'm like, hey, the nicer, better house that you also want to buy also went up by 30%, right? So if you're in terms of real wealth, what you can buy, you did not get any wealthier holding this real estate, right? And so I think using scarce goods, things you would actually want to purchase as your benchmark. So for me, that's Bitcoin. Bitcoin, I want to accumulate more Bitcoin. So if I hold things that are not Bitcoin and the price of Bitcoin goes up more than them, in Bitcoin terms, I'm actually more poor. And yeah, so just measuring in terms of dollars doesn't really do you any good when the actual dollar itself is less valuable.
And so what do you think about, as more people kind of understand this over time, what do you think this means for the price of those other assets as people more and more understand the difference between potentially the opportunity of holding some wealth in Bitcoin versus trying to own, multiple real estate properties as it's the same strategy, right? You're trying to outpace the devaluation of your local currency.
I think what we have already begun to see is more speculation and more risk seeking. So I think if you talk to any kind of I'm 24. If you talk to anybody my age, Zoomer and under, or even the millennial generation, if you told them, yeah, I can get you a 5% return this year or 2% return, they'll laugh in your face, right? That just doesn't cut it, right? The CPI is the barometer of real returns. We kind of, whether intuitively or subconsciously, we know that that's bogus. And that's why you've seen such a strong tendency towards meme coins, meme stocks, sports gambling. There's just more speculation going on in markets. The use of derivatives and options has increased, right? People are speculating more in markets because they know they need a higher rate of return to actually have this lifestyle that they want to live. And so for me, rather than buying zero day expiration options and just totally gambling on, 10 leg parlay, I'm just going to buy Bitcoin because I know Bitcoin will outpace the true debasement of the currency, or at the very least, it'll keep up with it, right? And so you kind of have a fork in the road here where it's like, do you want to hyper speculate in hopes that you can, go big or go broke? Or do you want to buy sound money that is going to go, tit for tat with the monetary supply? Plus you have this underlying wave of new adoption of Bitcoin, which also can spur exponential growth in the price. So I think we're going to continue to kind of see, extreme speculation across markets. And not to get into like strict investment advice, but I think that's why kind of the Coinbase stock has performed really well over the last year. And actually, Bitcoin's my benchmark, and I wouldn't suggest anybody, do anything other than buy Bitcoin. Like morally, I think that's like the, Michael Saylor talks about this. You can only advise people to buy commodities, not securities. But I do think places for alpha in the market is going to be something like a Coinbase stock, because you're buying literally the casino. And I think use of the casino and speculative vehicles, if you could have invested in DraftKings stock, a few years ago, it's gone way up. So I think you're going to continue to see more kind of use of these speculative vehicles. Like, I don't think meme coins are going away anytime soon. Now, the specific each coin is going to go away, but meme coins as sort of a genre, as an asset class, I think you're going to see more use of that. And kind of historically, if you look back in Weimar Germany, as their currency began to lose value exponentially, you saw this increase in degeneracy. So hyper speculative sort of financial markets. And then you saw degeneracy in the culture as well. It was a total like degenerate, like just crap hole. And you're seeing a similar sort of trend play out in the United States. So as the money collapses, you just see all sorts of breakdowns in society. And I think one place that really is obvious is in this hyper speculation in financial markets.
Yeah, that's a really great point. You know, from the Black Ward team, Seb Bunny wrote the book, The Hidden Costs of Money, which is sort of a layperson's understanding of like how all these social problems we're seeing today really are downstream of a monetary system that's designed to make it harder and harder for most people over time. And I totally agree with you. I think like this is part of the reason, you know, when you money that works properly, among other things, is a tool that allows people to plan for the future with certainty. And the less good money is at doing that job, the less optimism people can have about their ability to plan for the future. So I think that's, you know, that part of the challenge is when we're, people are en masse experiencing what we are, is it's hard to be optimistic. It's hard to, so you know, the reverse effect is sort of this almost nihilism. And it makes me wonder about people who are in their sort of teens and 20s right now, how they will feel about all this stuff and investing and, you know, what that will mean for a society, you know, as that generation turns into 30s and 40s, people are my age. So yeah, it's very interesting. You've actually, you wrote a book that does kind of touch on these subjects. And maybe we could just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I appreciate the plug there. It's The Conservative Case for Bitcoin. So it's you can find it on Amazon. You can find it on my Twitter handle. But I do have probably my favorite chapter in the book is about this idea. And it's about how fiat money has eroded the nuclear family from society. You see, if you look at any sort of major statistic indicative of a family, so the age people are getting married at, they're getting married later in life, they're having fewer kids, divorce rates are higher. Generally, the family, which is sort of the glue of our society, is falling apart. And the finger gets pointed at a lot of different things, but the most clear answer to me is the fact that the money is broken and that fiat is losing purchasing power. So a simple illustration of this would be, you know, 60 years ago, a man could work just an average job. Like my grandfather worked at just kind of a widget factory in a very rural location in the South, and he could support his entire family. My grandmother didn't have to work. She could stay at home and raise the children. All four kids got sent to college. They had a nice house, like multiple cars, etc. They lived a normal, great life off of one income. But now, just one single average income, you can't support a family like that. You just can't do it. And so now you have to have two incomes to support a household. You can really afford fewer children. Now the state has to raise those children because both parents have to work. People are, you know, putting off just even starting a family, period, because they're like, well, I want to have my financial bearings in order. I don't own a house yet. All this stuff, just the increased stress from merely just trying to support yourself financially is causing the family to break down in very disastrous ways, might I add.
Yeah, it's tragic. And all of those things that you said are very real. You know, birth rates are falling off a cliff. And I think these things are just like intuitively, everybody understands this just walking around like in Canada. And I know it's the same in the US. When I was in my 20s, there was no tent cities in every city. Like it's just, and now this is really over the last 4 years. It's become a super normal thing. And, you know, big cities have multiple tent cities. And I saw Rob Schneider, the comedian, talking about how San Francisco is perhaps one of the world's greatest experiments in camping. And I mean, it's funny, not funny, but I think that, like, you know, Bitcoin is to me apolitical, because solving the problem of money is something that everyone should care about. But I'm interested in these ideas, and I agree with you. I think that we don't have much of a prospect for a cohesive society when everyone is continually, you know, when it makes it difficult to have a sort of like the basic life that everyone's hoping to have.
Yeah. I think another place I've seen this a lot, and I need to come up with a good phrase to articulate this, but it's kind of like this extended like college frat life, right? So people that are in their late 20s, early 30s, like five roommates, kind of working like lower paying jobs, you know, all renting one house. You got five, six people in one house. It's like, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago, people this age would already have multiple kids. They'd have their own house. They'd be starting a family. And so you're just seeing this prolonged adolescence where they're not really building anything of stability. They're living paycheck to paycheck. There's no real progress being made well into adulthood. And so it's just you know, the knock-on effects of this we're going to see play out over the next few decades. And another point to that is I think this dichotomy between like the difference between the most successful people of a generation and the least successful is going to grow, right? So if you kind of look at baby boomers or the silent generation, a lot of them ended up in the same boat. Like there wasn't too, like the spread, you should say, of the successful and the least successful was very small versus, you know, millennials or Gen X. There's an even wider gap there. And then if you go down to Generation Z, my generation, you know, I have friends that are doing very well in life. And then I have some, you know, still living with their parents, like smoking weed all the time, right? I think this gap is going to continue to grow into the future. And so I think, you know, that's going to drive kind of a wedge socially. And then not to mention it's bad for the people, you know, who aren't seeing success and who aren't putting in the effort now. Because I think before you could kind of do the quote unquote, like right thing, just follow the crowd, you know, go to college, work your standard job at, you know, a giant corporation, saving a 401k, whatever. And you would do okay. Like you wouldn't be exceptional by any means, but you would get by. But I think kind of taking the standard generic path now is not going to lead to much success. And so, you know, the only people really having success in the economy that are my age are those who have studied the monetary system, understand exactly what's being played here, and then really put in the work to kind of row against that system.
Yeah, I feel like I'm really dating myself on this episode, but this is another one of those back in my day. But when I was in university, basically everybody who was at university, it would be an assumption that you were going to get out into the world and get a job and own a home. And that's only 20 years ago. And it really was that way. Like I don't remember once ever worrying that I would be able to afford a house. And today, like I would say, it's just completely inverted in the average. It seems like the average young person feels like this is something that they can never attain, which is, you know, shelter is like the floor of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And so, yeah, back to my point earlier about, you know, being able to plan for the future with certainty. Like if the future feels so uncertain, there just are going to be a certain percentage of people that feel like it's pointless to even try to plan. And it's just like a cascading, you know, tragic set of secondary outcomes, which I think is like, you know, to put it back on a positive spin, that this is why people like yourself and me, we get together and do these podcasts. And because they're, you know, the idea of a tool that is available to everyone that enables sort of financial empowerment and some optimism, ability to store wealth that you've earned in a tool that is sort of exempt from government, intentional government debasement, is pretty exciting. And it's something that kind of as many people as possible need to understand as quickly as possible.
Yeah, it truly is game changing. I wonder what people who aren't into Bitcoin, if they just haphazardly heard us talk about this, they might think that's ridiculous. But I could genuinely plan for in 4, 8, 10, 20 year time windows by virtue of that I know I have wealth that will maintain its purchasing power. Like I tell my friends, you know, get to half a Bitcoin, quarter of a Bitcoin, a tenth of a Bitcoin. And by the time you're 60, you'll be able to retire off of that, right? And so with that kind of at the back of your mind, you can really focus on enjoying the present day and building skills now. And you're not sweating about, oh, what, you know, what am I going to do next week to make rent or whatever? Like you can genuinely kind of have a peace of mind, which allows you to really be more focused and locked in on building skill sets, starting a family, just and thinking about things more for the long term. It's, you know, Saifedean talks about this ad nauseum in the Bitcoin Standard, which is the idea of time preference. Are you short-term minded, which would be a high time preference, or are you thinking for the long term, which would be a low time preference?
Yeah, maybe just touch on something you said at the start there is everybody thinks Bitcoin is ridiculous at the start. So if you're listening and you think this is ridiculous, I did too. Like I definitely remember my first initial time dismissing the idea of Bitcoin when I knew absolutely nothing about it was in 2017. And, you know, we all sort of start to take it seriously at the time that we're ready to. So this is how Bitcoin works. This might be a good time to wrap it, Mitchell. I want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing your insights and knowledge. You mentioned your Twitter handle earlier in the episode, and we'll include the link to your book in the show notes. Is there anywhere else we can point listeners to find your content or your You online?
No, that's it. At Mitchell Hoddle on Twitter, you'll find me there. I write a weekly newsletter for Blockware. So we're a vertically integrated Bitcoin mining company. If you're interested in mining Bitcoin, shoot me a DM or go to blockwaresolutions.com. Scott, I really appreciate you having me on. This was a good rip.
Yeah, likewise. And if you're listening and you made it all the way to the end of the episode, I want to thank you as well for tuning in and hope to see you again next week.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. BlockRewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits. Supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and VMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.